This is Let's Keep It Real with Sandy Joy Weston, your weekly dose of positivity with awesome stories and guests from all over the world. It's an opportunity to learn some great new things and expand your mind. We'll tackle topics from all areas of life, and as always with Sandy, the sky's the limit.
Hello, hello, my Let's Keep It Real people. Well, some of you may have already seen Melly on my Hey, I Got Something to Say program. And if you didn't, don't worry about it, because after I had her on that show, I said, oh man, we got to dive in deeper. I need the longer version of Melly. I was so impressed with her. I saw her speak. Some of it was like, wait a minute, Mayday, I don't understand that. So she broke it down for me. She made it user-friendly. And here she is. Melly Chow, how are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm awesome. So before we get into your word, I remember you were thinking about moving to California. So where do you come from? Are you in Philly, California, Canada, New York? Where are you?
Well, today I'm in Philly, originally from Toronto, so Canadian. Moved here for my last employer, which is Comcast. Trying to make a move out west just because it's to be part of like the greatest startup ecosystem in the world. I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't join that ecosystem. So I think the word of the day or like that I've been feeling lately is grit and resilience. Grit. Yeah, it just takes all of you to make life transitions, but also lean in hard, I think, to what you're meant to do, like your life's purpose and work.
I love that word. I haven't heard that in a little bit, grit. And people mention it about themselves, but I want to tell you, I've been doing this for 15 years. Nobody picked that word. But I love that you picked it. All right, listen. We're going to talk peeps off air because Melly is awesome. But also, didn't you want to move? Do you want to move to the Silicon Valley area?
Absolutely do. Yep.
I have a friend that just moved there and is in this field, and I'm going to be doing a workshop at the end of February. So I have to hook you up with my curator for TEDx's, Arena Ferguson.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I would love that.
She's in the digital space too, and you would just freaking love her. And she just moved there like a month ago from Apex, North Carolina. But I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Melly Chow. She gave you a little rundown, but here it is. She is an angel investor. Holler to all my angel investors out there. A venture capitalist, entrepreneur, IT technology management, strategy consultant, and product innovation executive with 20 plus years of experience across multiple industries, including telecommunications, cable utilities, power generation, banking, healthcare, government, and food. She is a venture partner at Archangel. Freaking love the name. Axion Fund, and the former executive director of competitive research and product strategy within a Fortune 50 company. Melly holds a BS in mechanical engineering. I'm sorry. Every time I read this, I just laugh because it's so awesome. Melly holds a BS in mechanical engineering from the University of Waterloo and an MBA from Kellogg Northwestern. And how do you spell Schulich School?
That's right. Schulich School of Business.
Business University. Melly resides in Philadelphia, but will always call Canada home. And Melly, I'm exhausted listening to all that because when I read that, I'm like, okay, she's about 80. It's a lot to do in one lifetime, you know? So I'm going to dive into, we're going to back up and do things a little bit different than I normally do, which I know you always love when I do that. But I want to know, we were talking a little bit about this off air. Mm-hmm. What drives you? Like I was at a workshop and we were talking a little bit about Brené Brown always says, what is your value system? When you show up every day, what do you show up with? What are your two top values?
Yeah, I think it always comes down to resilience and integrity, right? Like, can you get that job done, but not only do it well, but also, you know, hold true, you know, some of the values. I believe in business, you can do well while doing good. It is this sort of perfect balance or intersection of purpose and profit.
There's a book I have, and I wish I would have brought it in. And I don't think I have it here. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. I got a million books here. But it's a friend of mine did a TEDx, and it was about becoming an angel investor and how women are underfunded. And then there was this, I told you this documentary that came out. I don't know if you ever seen it called Show Her the Money.
And not yet. It's on my list.
And all of it, I didn't realize, I know I should, but a lot of women too, I think, you know, we want to give back. We do so much for charity and community service, but we forget that we can also do good while investing in businesses that would never get off the ground unless we invested in them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of intersection that I like sort of doing business around is like there's, you can still make an impact and drive results, but also do something that is meaningful. And that's actually what I want to kind of talk about today is like the path to mastery and self-actualization and just sort of fulfillment in life actually goes beyond like climbing the corporate ladder, following prescribed path, checking all the boxes. It lies in beating your personal hurdles and hence the grit, recognizing your own strengths and unique talents and passions and utilizing it to overcome what I call like to call the power law or sort of that exponential curve for growth.
I love that. But the thing I want to know about, let's start with overcoming the power law, breaking through the top decile. Because when I sent this out to my people, that's the one they had the most questions about. Do you mind if we dive into that first?
Yeah, I can definitely explain what I mean by overcoming the power law and breaking through to the top decile. So like at the heart of it, it's really about leaning into yourself and providing that little bit extra to outperform your peer group and break through to the top decile by doing your personal best. Because your best life's work is an extension of your identity, and you can achieve all this to achieve fuller purpose. And especially if you, to live your best life, you have to kind of follow your head, heart, and gut. And when those are in true alignment, you will overcome the power law. And so like, what is the power law, you ask? So it's the exponential growth pattern. There are a few ways of thinking about it. It's like the bigger they get, the faster they grow. It's also known as, some people, some scientists may on the call may recognize it as Pareto's principle, or even like if you recognize the bell curve, it's sort of the outer edges of the bell curve.
Okay.
And you can also observe it as like the 80-20 rule, where the top 20% entitles typically hold 80% of the value or the power. The other way of explaining it is probably like Moore's law, right? Where there's an exponential growth over time. Keep compounding. In fact, there's a really great book out there called Exponential Organizations, written by Salim Ismail, who I just saw yesterday in Philly at the Global Impact Forum. And he just reminded me that, you know, the exponential organizations basically takes on this sort of massive transformative purpose equals scale and ideas. Like that's kind of the key formula of how it works. Some folks may have heard Jim Collins talk about it in his book, Good to Great.
I got that book. That a freaking, like I got everything. I'm like a headshot. Like I got everything outlined. I love that book.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of like what I mean by the power curve. It's just this like growth by 10x or exponential compounding nature. And to do that, when you overcome it, then you can break out and get into that top decile. And that's what I mean by personal best and, you know, outperforming your peers by leaning into doing that little bit extra to align your best life with your head, heart, and gut.
Okay, so they had so many questions for you about your personal story in this. You ready?
Sure.
She's like, wait a minute, mayday. No, it's okay. So I'm telling you, they really were diving into this. And I think because of all the people out there, they're like me. I mean, I'm familiar with some of it, but I'm really familiar with the Good to Great book of all the books out there. And so that's probably why they were so interested in this. Number one question, did you always know? I love this question, so I have to ask it. Did you always know you were meant for greatness?
Absolutely not. And I think I used the word grit today because like there's some days that are just not great. In fact, they're not even good. And so like, what do you do to really push through? And I actually like to segment my days into like three parts, you know, like morning, midday, evening, and then like try to do like one thing, because obviously you get pulled into like a million directions throughout the day. Some of us are a slave to our inbox, but like, if I can just focus on that one thing in that segment of the day, then
Hold back. This is gold. Wait a minute. Stop there. Because I have a whole nother show coming up about time blocking, because everyone feels like a wing nut. Like, it's like, where's the nut? So I've never heard this. So we're going to call this Melly's Law. All right. So Melly's Day, you time block in. If I can get one thing done, can I use this with my clients? Do you mind if I borrow this?
Yes, go for it.
All right. This is genius. One thing done in like the morning.
Yeah, the morning. Afternoon, evening.
How many hours are we talking? Each block?
I would say like 4 hours. It's a 4 hour block.
Okay.
And so like, and I always tell my mentees and my direct reports, like we are a reflection of our calendar. It is, our calendars are sort of a leading indicator of future success. But we can't always be a slave to our calendar, because there are some other things that I'm going to share with you today, tactics and strategies for sort of overcoming that power law, right? And sort of how do you time scale, right, as a single individual? Because overcoming that power law, or like climbing that giant exponential curve, obviously takes some large feats, you know, and bending, you know, space-time continuum a little bit.
Can you come to my house? No, I'm serious. I just recently said, which is great, things are working out for me. Thank you, universe. And I have a lot of things, but that's when you mentioned the book, Good to Great, I remember Jim Collins and I remember the hedgehog, and like, is it, you know, are you passionate about it? Are you good at it? And is it pretty income? And I'm like, okay, I need to sit down, think of those things. And then where am I putting my time and my calendar? But you're right. I never thought my calendar reflects who I am.
Yeah.
Well, if I say yes to something, that means I'm saying no to something else.
That's right. Yep. So it's so not only is a time a reflection of sort of a leading indicator of success and achievements and accomplishments, but you know, the top five people that you spend the most time with are a reflection of sort of your values and who you are. So just have to be mindful and strategic of, you know, how you spend your time, essentially.
I like some of these people. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. I love them all. Does it count if my dog is one of the five?
I think it needs to be people.
He really gets me. All right, let's move on, because there's a lot to get in here. So I want to stop with turning the flywheel, because that was the next thing you had under Good to Great and turning the flywheel. So I read it, I got some of it, but I need you to break it down for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, in terms of like getting to great and overcoming that power law, like the question is, how do you do it, right? Because there's only so much time in the day. And we already talked about like how you kind of have to spend space, time, continuum to kind of do this.
Can you give me five steps, because I want to make sure I do this today.
Okay. So I have three steps. So
whoa. Yes. Okay.
Good. So the first one is finding your flywheel, your personal flywheel. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. The second step is, you know, following your heart to seize opportunities and experiment during uncertainty. Okay. So the third one is trust your gut. So, and lean into your intuition. So
third one I got good. The other ones I'm not sure about.
So finding your flywheel, as you mentioned earlier, is really about following your head. So remember we said, head, heart, and gut alignment leads you to do the greatest.
Can you hold that again? Because they're going to want to get that down. Head, heart,
gut alignment will lead you to do your greatest work and lifetime achievement. And so like, to break it down on the first one, like find your flywheel. So there is a book called Strategy Beyond the Hockey Stick. And being Canadian, I love that reference.
Wrote that one?
It basically states, it talks about corporate strategy, and it talks about how like when the odds of a company's economic profit follows the power curve, essentially. So same thing, follows the power curve. And so that the top quintile of companies basically receive 90% of the profits, irrespective of industry, sector, goods and services sold. So essentially what they're saying, that the markets don't discriminate and capital flows to the top to sort of the best. And so like when it comes to your flywheel, and so I'll give you an example of mine. So my personal flywheel I've built, and some people call it like the triple threat or my trifecta. In that, like for me, it's been, you know, being an entrepreneur, being an advisor, and then being a venture capitalist or angel investor.
Yeah.
And one thing that I do feeds the other, right? And I guess we also talked about like, you know, segmenting your day, like morning, midday, and evening. So like in terms of like these kind of facets or hats that I wear in my life, you know, I have three, and not everyone gets the most focus at any one time, but like jointly, it creates this flywheel of purpose for me where, you know, the small wins accumulate over time and continue to grow and improve each part of my flywheel, where it continues to gain momentum and hopefully over time, you know, self-perpetuate and even like might even move itself. Like, so it definitely makes things easier as you gain momentum in any one area. So like the first area I talked about was entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
For me, it started like super early. I actually come from like a long line of entrepreneurs. You know, entrepreneurship is in my DNA, is in my genes. My father was actually third generation entrepreneur and business owner as well, with a sort of biomedical instrumentation company that he had acquired from his boss at the time. Like, I remember him asking me at the age of 8, and this was him working for his boss. And he basically said, "Hey, I'm thinking like there's an opportunity to buy this company. I'm thinking of buying it. What do you think?" You know, and that was his way of sort of getting buy-in from his whole family, like, and to kind of support it. And so when he asked me that question at the age of 8, I was like,
eight years old,
but daddy, what are you going to do instead? And so I think it dawned on him that, you know, like this is what, you know, he was meant to do and what he was made for. But the things that I learned at that really early age is that, you know, most decisions or most important decisions that you make, the information is asymmetric, meaning you only have so much information to make that information, and definitely sort of lopsided. And he was lucky in that, like, he ran the division that they were selling off because it was like a private sale, and he was running the division already, and it's just a matter of like total buy-in for ownership stake. So transfer of ownership is what it was going to be. But he saw, because he was also like the lead salesperson, the pipeline. And he knew that there was a really strong pipeline of future looking sales and cash flows. And hence like the valuation that he acquired it for was definitely worthwhile, essentially, you know? And that's kind of when I learned that at a really young age, that information is always asymmetric, and like you should always make decisions based on as much data as you can. But at the end of the day, like there's a limitation on that. The other thing I also learned, because a lot of people are like, "Hey, Melly, why don't you just work for the family business?" And so what I've also learned is like market size matters, in that you always want to be a small fish in a big pond. And in the case of our family business, we are essentially a big fish in a small pond, right? There's only room for like 1 liter. There's only room for...
I got it.
Yeah, there's a limitation in growth. And so, yeah, that was something that, you know, that my brother now leads the business, because that was sort of his path. And I wanted to move on to do bigger and better things, as well as, you know, sort of help entrepreneurs. Because in our last talk, talked about, you know, how I love helping entrepreneurs. And it's really a passion of mine to make a difference, to support the heroes of change. Because innovation and disruption is truly happening through these founders, through the startup and innovation ecosystem. But, you know, if I can help one person make one decision at one time, then I've like done my job. I didn't want to just make one bet and work on one operating company. So I took this sort of portfolio approach and became the heroes of heroes by becoming a VC or angel investor, so that I can, you know, drive broader impact and change.
I want to hold it there because I'm a very visual person. Did you just say you didn't want to take one bet? Is that what you said?
One bet. I didn't want to just like bet my time and life on one operating company. I wanted to like spend time across like a number of operating companies and do that through, you know, funding and advisory.
Yeah. How about your family? I'm sure they were supportive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm moving into the era of my career where I'm able to sort of pick and choose what I want to do. And I think more and more like venture and angel investments just gives you that like latitude and runway to drive the most impact and change with the time that you have. Like I said, the whole industry follows the power curve. So it's really important, you know, to be able to like amplify the time spent, right? Through this, what I call the flywheel. And my flywheel is entrepreneurship, venture capital, angel investments, and advisory. On the last note of my trifecta around advisory, this really came through my career as a consultant and for like, you know, large firm, started at Accenture, doing IT tech consulting, and then a boutique firm doing management and strategy consulting. And then most recently, my time at Comcast, where I built, you know, a world-class competitive intelligence product strategy group. And I called ourselves sort of the A-team, so much so that, you know, they recognized that, hey, you did it for Comcast. When we acquired Sky, they're like, can you build this team at Sky as well? And I was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. But they were like, don't teach them how to fish, don't fish for them. And I was like, okay, no problem. I can do that. But it actually was harder than it sounded because A, the pandemic happened. So like try building a global team completely virtually, as well as like a capability that's sort of brand new to an organization and to most industries. And then also the fact that there's no like, you know, this skill set is quite unique. Like when I look to hire a team of people, like there's no like regulation or association body that kind of has this type of skill set. Like you don't go to school for competitive intelligence and product strategy, right? I think in MBA schools, there's a lot of corporate strategy. There's a lot of, you know, product design, venture design, but there's not necessarily this area, this unique intersection of competitive product strategy, competitive intelligence. And so while I was building this team, some of the lessons learned for this building this sort of enterprise world-class capability is what I call the four A's. And the four A's framework, essentially, and where the goal is always to help the organization build differentiation, a moat around their product and offerings, and then like competitive advantage, right? Yep. And so with the four A's, the first A is essentially access to intelligence, right? Like that's the first and foremost thing you need to have is access. And that comes in the form of primary research. So direct connection to your users, right? For that feedback loop, customer surveys, you know, feedback, secondary research, right? Like through vendor partner data and intel, you know, in the case of television, it's usually like the broadcasters, right? Collecting data to gain more advertising dollars, because it's always about eyeball measurement, right? That sort of thing. Third party data, right? Like where other competitors may have information, associations, organizations, like regulatory bodies, FCC, like that sort of third-party data. And then of course, conferences, because I always said like, as soon as information or research becomes published, it's already outdated. Like you have to be where, you know, it's like wet cement, you know, it can't be there when the concrete's already poured. Otherwise, like it's old news and you got to get in front of it to understand leading indicators rather than lagging indicators. And so that's access to intel, the first A. The second A is applying frameworks. So understand.
Hold a second though, because there's some things that it seems like common sense, but I didn't think of it. I didn't think of it as like once it's published, forget it. It's already out there.
Yeah. Like, remember we talked about information being asymmetric and making decisions, data-driven decisions as much as possible. So a lot of times, like as soon as data becomes published and widely known and available on the internet, you know, you don't have an advantage. You're making decisions the same information that everybody else has, right? Where the value and the economic return and, you know, the outcomes are already all baked in. When you're looking for advantage, competitive advantage, you have to look ahead, right? And I call it seeing around corners, reading between the lines, and sort of like deciphering the signal through the noise, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's very interpretive. And that's the next A. It's the applying the framework.
Yeah.
So there are frameworks in competitive product strategy, corporate strategy that help, you know, my analysts and other competitive intelligence folks to like kind of think through what they're seeing and hearing to kind of decipher what it all means, right? Like connect the dots essentially. And you do this through applying the frameworks. And the third A is, I call it agents with agency, because you need to have boots on the ground. Like you can't be removed from a market geo or like where your products and services are being used. And like, you want to be as close to the customer as possible. You want to be close to the feedback as possible. And it's almost like fresh intel, right? And the better you are at this, it's kind of like the flywheel, where you gain enough momentum that it doesn't become a pull, it becomes a push. People know that you need this information. People know that you care. People that know that you're making decisions. People know that, you know, the data is important for to change outcomes. And so you want to be that magnet to effectively attract that information towards you. And with venture, it kind of looks like deal sourcing, right? Like people know that you're funding companies, so they're going to seek you out to like, you know, bring you, you know, to sort of ask you if you want to get involved in their company, right? And so that's agents with agency and having enough boots on the ground for coverage of being as close as you can to the edge of, you know, possibility, but also as close as you can to your customers, where products and services are being used and either loved or not, or hated, right? And then last but not least, awareness of the fundamentals. And it's similar to the frameworks, but the fundamentals are different in that fundamentals are more backwards looking and frameworks are more forward looking. So leading versus lagging indicator, where the fundamentals are about looking backwards with like annual reports and, you know, data that you have, and being able to kind of put that picture together at a very like basic level. So I always said to my analysts, like, you want to do Monet, but you kind of, or dripping clocks like Salvador Dali, you kind of have to get the basics of still life first, right? And the mechanics of, you know, paint by numbers. And so the same thing with competitive intelligence, in that the awareness of the fundamentals, you know, go back to the annual reports, the 10K, and, you know, everything that's available, and put that picture together before you go ahead and connect any dots that may or may not be there.
Melly, you need to teach a course. You said there's no course, remember? Like, you need to go in and be a professor. All right. So I want to stop right there, because look at me, I'm raising my hand, teacher, professor. So I want to go back to my audience, and you're saying this is your flywheel. So let's just say, for those people that have no clue what the flywheel was, and it's in the Jim Collins book, Good to Great, which a lot of people have it. Would you recommend for people, like, how would you recommend they find their flywheel? Do you think they should get the book? How would they do it?
Yeah, I think there's a number of tools available that you can kind of do that. And your flywheel needs to be at the intersection of your strengths. So like, what are you good at? Your passions, what are you interested in? What gives you energy? And then like, you know, what is it that you really want to do? Right. So there are tools out there called, like, StrengthsFinder 2.0 is a really great assessment tool. Insights, Myers-Briggs, doing a personal SWOT. Like, these are all great tools to be able to kind of identify, you know, passion and strengths for purpose, like to really define that purpose for yourself. I love this quote by Mark Twain. He says, like, the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. So it really is about passion, purpose, passion meets purpose, right? because from understanding what your strengths are.
Yeah.
And build that flywheel. That's how you're going to get there to overcome the power law.
Yeah. I love this. I love it. I love it. I love it. I haven't heard that in a while, the Mark Twain quote. Okay. So I just want to make sure, let's just hold on. So focus on, because we have a key message you want to take away. The action is focus on finding your own flywheel, not Mally's, to overcome the power law.
That's right.
Okay. And this is so important. It's so important.
And then, the second tactic is about following your heart and passion, where you seize opportunities and experiment in times of uncertainty. And I'm going to anchor this back to like the venture capital industry again, because venture capital industry follows the power law, which simply means that, you know, only the top quartile outperform the S&P. And so like, if you're an investor terms, that means like, if you're not outperforming the S&P, there's like really no point in investing in alternative asset class, because alternative asset class are higher risk, higher reward, but you kind of need to outperform the S&P for there to be, you know, increased reward for your risk, essentially. And so I'd love to share what I mean by that. So like through
absolutely.
Yeah. So
by the way, I just want you to know, she put a little heart on number two, sees opportunity to experience during uncertainty.
Yeah, because it's about following your passion in that case, right? Yeah. And for me, it's been a number of experimentations in my life and failing forward. So the first one would be like the Revolving Kitchen, which is my food tech startup. So I founded the Revolving Kitchen with my co-founder back when I was right out of my MBA, so venture design course. And we were successful quite early on in getting a lot of traction, totally bootstrapped. And essentially the Revolving Kitchen was a cloud kitchen or ghost kitchen. So like Airbnb for commercial kitchen rentals before even existed, right? So you're working with, it's a marketplace, it's dual-sided, right? With supply and demand, where demand is basically your aspiring chefs and restaurateurs and, you know, restaurant owners. And then your supply is commercial kitchens that are underutilized with excess capacity, which was a lot during the pandemic, but like, I think it's the working with the food entrepreneurs that was like the more challenging. And what I really learned here is that market category matters. Like the industry that you're in matters, because like, it's like all boats rise during high tide and you want to pick a tide where they're, you know, where it's rising. And so that kind of brings me to that sort of this next experience, because like this is when Comcast called me back and was like, hey, you know, we want to stand up a competitive intelligence competitive product strategy group. You know, would you like to come back? And so at first I was like, I don't know. They're like, well, I'm like, what's the deliverable? What's the outcomes? Like, how am I measuring success? And it was like research. And I was like, really, just research, like deliverables and not like business outcomes or, you know, growth metrics or like whatever. And they're like, research. And I was like, okay, I can do that. So I rejoined Comcast and started to like build this competitive intelligence group, which I talked about earlier, like around the 4 A's, and did that over the last sort of 6 years. And as I was doing this, you know, we reported out and did research on every single competitive category that Comcast competes. So Xfinity, all B2C, you know, in everything, every category they had products, but also every category that they were contemplating entering and as a growth strategy and even tangential to what they're doing to date. And so when the pandemic happened, you know, we all were sheltering in place. Everybody worked from home.
Yeah.
And Comcast is a very vertical HQ centric company. And so like what happened there was, you know, we used to innovate. We used to like have serendipitous, you know, in-person collisions, that sort of thing, where innovation can happen sort of more organically. And so the challenge was, you know, people still wanted to innovate. People wanted to work on cool things. But the question was like, what do we work on? And at Comcast, we had this thing called, you know, Lab Week, which is a lot like Google 20% time, how you can like work on whatever you want within a quarter, like during a week sort of thing to demo and whatever. And the question I was always get, you know, as part of my research group was like, hey, what should we build? Or like, what would be innovative? What would be like useful for Comcast? And mm-hmm. so like my trends report was kind of born out of necessity during the pandemic, where we reported out on sort of trends that mattered for a large high-tech technology, media, entertainment conglomerate, right? And it was like sort of top 10 trends that we would distill. And it was born out of necessity because for a company that was very HQ-centric and no longer meeting in person, and we were virtual for about 2 years, was to put some strategic bounds around and bookends on like what people, what would be strategically important and relevant to Comcast's product strategy. That, and it was meant to inspire, inform, and influence future sort of tech trends and things that we build. And so we did this for about 5 years, where people looked to my team to kind of publish this. And it went broad. The audience was so broad. It was like Comcast, NBC, Universal, you know, Fandango, DreamWorks. It like everybody sort of had a copy of this on an annual basis. And so for the first time this year, I was able to publish it publicly. So, and I think you saw it at the WITS Summit. Yeah. I published it on behalf of Archangel Axion, the fund that I work at now. And it really speaks to our deep tech thesis, essentially, and even like product development and consumer products, like what are the technologies that you know, will make a difference for consumers. And personally, I find there's a little bit of a nostalgia because it's a nod to, for those who are familiar with the Mary Meeker Internet Report. Mary Meeker was an iconic, or still is, investor and one of the first like female women investors out of Silicon Valley. And at the time it was Kleiner Perkins. So the Mary Meeker, like people would like wait with bated breath for this internet report to come out. And it was like pages and pages of like when the dot-com bubble was first happening, right?
Yeah.
And so like fast forward, you know, a few decades, and now we're into Web3. And like, that's what I hope to capture the hearts and minds of with my Connected Consumer Annual Trends Report, is like just kind of this inspirational look into like what is really, what matters from a tech perspective, but for the connected consumer now, the digital consumer, essentially.
First of all, that's how we met. Your presentation blew me away. It blew me away. I was just like, I didn't know that. It's not even my area. And I was taking all these notes, you know, it was so fascinating. So I'm so happy. I'm so happy you got to publish it. I mean, what a great accomplishment. And the fact that it was, like you said, it went over, that's a lot of companies that you mentioned. I mean, that's freaking amazing. All right. So I want to hold up right there because I know it's really great how you broke it down. And then here's the action items. And you mentioned this before, and it says accelerate through corners. And I didn't quite grasp that. So maybe you can break that down again.
Yeah. So in the event of uncertainty or like ambiguity, like in those times, my advice is to seize those opportunities, like lean into doing and accelerate through that corner, even when you can't kind of see around it, even when it's like misty or foggy or vague, right? And I guess the advice here is that if you're well-read around understanding trends and like, you know, what is possible, the art of the possible, and you're constantly following your passion, right? Then, you know, then take the leap and accelerate through that corner, like take the opportunity, because the future is already here. It's just sort of unevenly distributed, right? And lean into the areas where it's showing.
Okay. I tried to grasp that because I know you have that quote here by William Ford Gibson. What does it mean by the future is, after all, the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed.
Yes. So
I don't get it. I really don't get it, Melanie.
So what that means is like, there's a bell curve in life of like sort of early adopters, mass market laggards or late adopters.
I got the bell curve. Okay.
Yeah. And so the future is already here, meaning it's happening on the edges. So not necessarily the mass market or the late adopters, but it's happening in these pockets. And usually it's early adopters or startups, venture, you know, incubators, accelerators. Like, it's happening somewhere. It's just not happening in sort of like the lexicon that we're all used to and sort of the popular culture or, you know, popular moment, right? And so it's like going and observing where it's happening already and figuring out ways to scale and cross the chasm into sort of the mass market.
Now I got it. Okay. And my favorite quote, no matter what, is doing nothing is not an option. Like,
yeah, because like I said, accelerate through that corner, experiment, seize the opportunity, like just, you know, doing and fail forward because it you never know. It leads to the next thing.
You know, I know you say you have grit, but this takes a lot of not just confidence. Remember I was telling you mine is courage. This takes a lot of courage. I mean, it really does, because you have to be uncomfortable with, you know, all right.
Yep.
May not work. Maybe look like fool. I mean.
That's right. And that actually brings me right into the last point about trusting your gut.
Oh, because, I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you have your flywheel, you know your strengths and passion, and you're seizing your purpose, and you're leaning into these uncertain moments and experimenting and doing and failing forward, like ultimately, you know, you're in the uncharted where there's the unknown, where there's no information, right? Like assuming that you're making all decisions with as much data as you can, you know, there comes to a point where there just is no information because like you're beyond the fringe of uncertainty or the fray. And so that's when you trust your gut. And what I've seen in my research is that like most transformative innovation of our time didn't come from customers' requests. Like, because if you ask a customer what they want, they'll just be like faster horses, right? Or market research, because the best competitive research and market research just leads to parity, right? But where it does come from is intuition, imagination, creativity, curiosity, taste, and guts.
Yeah.
And so I have like, I can rattle on and on all the examples of where this has happened, but I'll give you sort of the top three. So for those who remember Jim McClavey's Square. And so Jim McClavey is one of the, I call it PayPal mafia, right?
Yeah, yeah. I know all about it.
Yeah. And so Jim McClavey founded a startup along with his co-founder, who was the founder of Twitter as well. And so they set on a mission to create and disrupt sort of the fintech industry and payment space with this device called Square, and where you take it to merchants and they can run your credit card, essentially. He has a book all about that. Square is now rebranded as Block, but at the time it was incredibly disruptive. But what he did, and he built it for his friend who was a glass blower in like Missouri or whatever, and wanted to sell one of his, you know, glass blown pieces of art. And the question was like, how do I make this transaction even happen or like receive payment for it? And so he, you know, designed for one and deployed to many, essentially, this solution, which is then Square, right? So it was like, if you look at like the numbers, and he talks about in his book, like an upside down pyramid in fintech, how like, you know, the credit card companies would just like keep you out because it's too cannibalization of their current business models, et cetera, et cetera. And like, how do you capture the long tail of like unstructured markets and people needing to make these transactions where the transaction fees are like too high to to even like warrant that digital transaction, and hence like kind of holding everybody back in this sort of cash society, right? So anyway, like my point is like Square broke through because he designed for one purpose, which was like his friend to make this transaction, and it trusted his gut and like built the case and, you know, was super gritty about it and then like broke through. Another great example is Amazon Alexa. Like nobody asked for a cylindrical device that you can talk to, right?
Oh.
And if you look at the numbers initially, I mean, it wasn't profitable. you know, they practically had to give the devices away to drive adoption, to get people to understand and use Alexa, right? But now people can't live without it. It's like absolutely, you know, in terms of like voice control and these virtual assistants, they're kind of ubiquitous, right? Another example would be the iPhone with the camera. Initially, I think even Steve Jobs was like, why would anybody need a camera on their phone? But then it unlocked like, you know, Instagram and all these, you know, different use cases and ability. Now people can't even live without their smartphone and camera. So like, I think there are some things that goes beyond data, right? Even with the best data and data being asymmetric, you still need, like, there's that sense of intangible where you have to follow your intuition and kind of use creativity, curiosity, imagination, taste, and guts to kind of lead you to the right decision. And I have an example for you where this happened for me. And this, again, was kind of back in my Comcast days where as part of my research group, we created what's called Comcast Invent. Invent stands for innovation, visioning, experimentation, and transformation, where Comcast Invent was essentially an immersive workshop to co-create and like bring, you know, assemble a diverse set of cross-functional internal experts to rapidly uncover a breadth of innovation opportunities with our organization and co-create and plan to productize them through sort of joint alignment. And so that is something that was super effective in that, you know, it solved for problems that, like to Jim's point around sort of disrupting or cannibalizing existing paradigms and models, right? Like there's no way Visa, MasterCard, or Amex would have gone and created Square, right? You have to kind of disrupt yourself to do that and be willing to kind of cannibalize your products. And so at Comcast, we applied this towards the future of pay TV. You know, like what is the future of pay TV? You know, and, you know, streaming's already here. Like what is next? And how do we find our new sort of product S-curve and disrupt and cannibalize ourselves? So that's why it was really great, because as you can imagine, in a Fortune 50 company, you've got a million opinions and alignment is really challenging. Yeah. And more importantly, everybody's an engineer and needs, you know, or a business person and needs the data. And in a lot of these cases, the data doesn't exist. And so I think ultimately what we learned is that in this age, experience is the differentiator, right? And a lot of the times you can't really quantify experience when things are like seamless or frictionless. Like they just show up as issues or problems, but not necessarily like when something works magically and like it's literally like magic, like you can't really quantify that. And I think a company like Apple really gets that, right? And a great example of this sort of experience as a differentiator is like probably AirPlay or AirDrop, right? Where things just work across all your devices, you know, syncing information and data. And like, imagine having like written the business case for that, like, hey, I need this feature to work. And like, it's just the summation of all these things that lead to an amazing experience, but you can't necessarily like quantify like a business driver, business case for. So I think the best companies recognize that, you know, there is an element of trusting your gut. And more importantly, on a personal level, I think like we all need to learn to like lean and not ignore our gut and also like leave room for serendipity, right? We all learned that during the pandemic. And we're continuing to learn this with Gen AI, you know, that like automation is great, but like automating things that are fundamentally broken just introduces more bias, you know, and you're just reinventing the same problems.
That's a whole nother podcast that I have questions about.
You know, I'm thinking, even in my field, Melly, I would come out with things and they would think I was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Like, I'm sure you know kettlebells, right? You know what a kettlebell is? Well, I was trying to put handles on iron belt before they were even doing it. And they're like, oh God, Cindy's lost her mind, right? But I said, this is going to be huge. It's going to be huge. Even though you can imagine as a health club owner to ship kettlebells, they're very expensive. So it doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work out. And the thing that I regret at different times, but we did it. And we, you know, and the same thing with Spin. It was in California. I'm like, it's going to be huge. And that was really before right. the internet was so big. Now it's like, you know, it, like you said, everyone knows it. Back then there were bikes in dark rooms, but no one knew it here on this coast.
Right.
Exactly. To be one of the first really matters. Mm-hmm. And the times that I could just, you know, shake myself is when I doubted my gut.
Yep.
Because when I did it, it was always amazing and great. But there's times I hesitated and somebody else came into the market a bit before me. Right. It was good, but it wasn't great.
Right. And I'll leave you with this Brené Brown quote. You mentioned Brené Brown earlier. Yeah, exactly. She says that intuition is not a single way of knowing. It's our ability to hold space for uncertainty and our willingness to trust the many ways we've developed knowledge and insight, including instinct, experience, faith, and reason. And so like with that, lean into the action, like make those decisions, seize the opportunity and experiment, I think is my message.
I love you. This is amazing. You're incredible. There's so much to dive in here. I know you're going to New York and we got to wrap up and I went a little longer, but I didn't want to leave out anything. You know what I mean? Because it's so much amazing information that can be applied to so many different people. And my question for you, which was my third biggest question I got when I sent your information out, is 5 years from now, where is Melly? What is she going to be doing? Because this is a lot and you could go in different directions. In 5 years, where do you see yourself?
Yeah, in 5 years.
Silicon Valley. No, I don't know.
Yeah, in Silicon Valley, probably a global citizen. I would love to have launched my own fund at that point.
Oh.
I would love to invite LPs, so limited partners and investors who really believe in leveraging technology, so deep tech, to do good, so drive impact and purpose. And of course, it wouldn't be me if I didn't really lean into, you know, supporting the marginalized, underrepresented, the funding that wouldn't normally get funded, right? So I think that's the type of fund I want to raise and the type of impact I want to drive. And I think I can do that by either being part of or launching a fund.
I have to. I'm sitting here. I know everyone's listening, but I have to introduce you to Catherine Gray, who was the originator of Show Her the Money documentary. That's all over. Okay. Because I mean,
yeah, I can't wait.
There's such synergy there. And she's out in California. Same thing with Arena. So we got to do that. Women power, baby. All right. Before we go, though, is there anything that we didn't get in that you want to get in to men and women around the world?
I think this message is simple. Wholehearted living is about bringing your whole self into everything you do. So make decisions when your head, heart, and gut are in total alignment. Because everything you could possibly ever have, need, or want is already right inside you. And with that, you know, the world would be remiss if they didn't see your unique gifts and talents and, you know, share that with the world.
I love it. HHG, baby. All right, my Let's Keep It Real people. Come on. Melly's the bomb. I want you to, we would both really love it and appreciate it if you shared, liked, and rated this episode. There's so many people that would benefit it. And Melly, if they want to reach out to you, how can they reach out and find you?
I think the best way is my LinkedIn, just Melly Chow on LinkedIn.
And until next time, you know what I'm going to say. Thanks, Melly, and toodles, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to share and subscribe if you enjoyed the show. And remember, keep spreading the positive.